another check, including a run-up of the engine. Check, double check, triple check. Then you're ready to fly.
An airliner full of military personnel and their families left McCord Air Force Base 55 years ago and within hours had vanished into the sea off the coast of Alaska. To this day, no one knows exactly what happened. Historian Felix Bunnell is here, brought to us by the King County Library System. You reported on this last year.
Yeah, it was the morning of June 3rd, 1963. DC-7, operated by Northwest Airlines, that's a four-engine propeller plane, kind of the last of the propeller airliners, took off from McCord with about 101 people aboard and headed for Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska, about 2.5 hours out of McCord, just north of Haida Gwaii, what they used to call Queen Charlotte Island. It crashed into 8,000 feet of water. There were no survivors, no bodies recovered, and only about 1,500 pounds of wreckage was found floating on the surface. No cause for the crash was ever determined. Coincidentally, it was just announced yesterday that the search for MH370 was called off after 4 years. And over the weekend, there was this great story in the New York Times about a group called Project Recover that had found a B-24 bomber in the Pacific and brought closure to these families, including people who'd never been born when their uncle died. And this is very emotional, even 74 years later. So last year, we met two people who had actual personal connections to Flight 293, actually remembered people who were lost. One was Susan Francis, who lives in Southern California. Susan was an only child. She told me that Jody Whipke was her best friend. Jody had even lived with Susan's family for a while, and the two were like sisters. So 55 years ago, they were both 16 and living in El Paso, Texas, when Jody's father got transferred to Alaska, and Jody's family was lost aboard Flight 293. I asked Susan a few days ago if it gets any easier to cope with the loss of her friend 55 years later.
You know, it doesn't ever get to be okay. It just gets to be, after all these years, just commonplace. It just happened, and there's nothing you can do about it. But I don't think of her any less. I mean, I've moved on with life. I'm not swallowed up by this, but Jody was a very significant part of my first 16 years of life, and she's still very much a part of my heart now.
I also spoke with Greg Barrowman of Maple Valley. Greg was 9 when his 17-year-old brother Bruce headed north to Alaska for his first Army posting. You know, Greg has a private memorial in his backyard, and he's reached out several times to elected officials and to the military, asking for their help to locate and recover whatever might be left of Flight 293. It wasn't long after the anniversary last year that Greg heard from the Defense Department about his most recent request.
I was hopeful when I contacted them and had various conversations from the Pacific as well as the national organization, and was told that my request didn't fall within the exact guidelines. While the 58 servicemen were all on active duty, they didn't qualify because it was in a Cold War situation and it wasn't really a legitimate conflict, which I would say in turn, I would disagree.
So the Army said they weren't going to search for Flight 293. It was too deep and too long ago. But as a result of last year's story, Greg and Susan have been in contact with each other, and the three of us have chatted a few times. Now, they've created a modest organization and a website, Flight293Memorial.com. They know there must be others like them who lost family and friends aboard Flight 293, and they want to hear from them. They believe it's a numbers game. You know, the more names and stories they can gather, the better they can make their case to the elected officials in multiple congressional districts and to the military to do something to try and bring closure to the survivors. Susan Francis says seeking closure just makes sense.
I don't think I'm the only one in the world who really has a deep sense of loss, even though so many years have passed. And I think the reason to do something like that, to form some kind of community or reach out and communicate with people, is because I just have to say it's the right thing to do for those that are lost. It's the right thing to do.
And so these folks contacted you after last year's story.
Yeah, and I've been in touch with them a few times, and I also found this group, you know, Project Recover, that was in the story in the New York Times. I reached out to them earlier in the week, and they said the group's not really familiar with Flight 293, and it didn't come as a surprise. It seems like Greg and Susan feel marginalized and forgotten. You know, I think probably because 293 was a civilian airliner under military charter, and also it was the Cold War, right? The Cold War is a sort of, there's no iconic battlefields, there's no decisive winner of the Cold War, I guess, although I guess we eventually won, right? But there's sort of this, the right to closure that families of World War II, Korean War, other more recent conflicts, the right to closure they feel about their lost relatives. Cold War people don't seem to have that right. They seem to be sort of like, 293, it's too long ago, it's the water's too deep, we're not going to search for it. So they know, Susan and Greg know, that if they gather enough names, they can reach out to someone like Project Recover or maybe Paul Allen's Undersea Exploration Group.
I mean, yeah. There's got to be a billionaire out there somewhere who would take this on as a challenge.
Yeah, and just demonstrate the fact that this is not, there's these 101 families with personal connections who probably a lot of people are still alive.
Sure.
Go to this Flight Memorial, flight293memorial.com, or share this My Northwest story, especially with aviation social media groups or military family groups. Spread the story around and help Greg and Susan find more people to connect with.
Historian Felix Bunnell. Thanks, Felix. On some issues, I tend to see America as being full of these family dinner tables with the pro-Trump people on one side and the anti-Trump people on the other side, and they're all arguing over the facts. And every Wednesday, we turn to CBS News White House correspondent Major Garrett to help with those discussions. And this morning, what I want to know is who's right on the issue of separating families at the border, taking the children away. Is that something new, or is it something Donald Trump invented? People on one side of the table would say that if somebody commits a crime in the wider society, they're arrested and they are separated from their families. So what's the difference?
Right. They would say precisely that. And those are the words spoken to us here at the White House, the reporters who were asking Kirstjen Nielsen, the Homeland Security Secretary, a couple of weeks ago on this very point. And she said, look, it's a crime. When you commit a crime in America, whatever the crime is, and you're found guilty of that, you're separated from your family. Why should it be any different for an illegal immigrant? So to your first question, have children been separated before? Yes, they have. Is that U.S. law? Yes, it is. What we're talking about here and debating is the level of magnitude and the universality of the application of that law. This administration, even as it's been in power longer, has stepped up the frequency with which it prosecutes everyone stopped at the border for crossing illegally. And so when you prosecute everyone, everyone is subject to those rules, which are if you have a child with you, whether it's your child by birth or just traveling with you, you're separated. Why? Because those children can't be put in adult detention facilities. The Obama administration did it, previous administrations did it on a case-by-case basis and far less frequently than this Trump administration has starting in the beginning of May when it really ramped up this process. So it's existing law, it's happened before, but the frequency with which it's happening is what is new. And the administration argues it does that because it wants to deter people from coming to the border in the first place. And they say, if you come to the border and you have children with you, the emotional trauma is coming because we are going to separate you because you're all going to be prosecuted.
Yeah.
The big difference here, Dave, is that this administration considers illegal border crossing a serious, serious crime. The Bush administration did not. The Obama administration did not. Not as serious as other crimes because oftentimes people cross the border to work in America, to take jobs that were available and that oftentimes could not be filled any other way. So previous administrations thought of this as kind of an administrative infraction, not a heavyweight crime. The Trump administration defines it differently. It's a serious crime, and you're going to be prosecuted.
By the way, last night at his speech, he said that Mexico, let's see, in the end, this was important, this is a new addition, in the end, Mexico is paying for the wall. Does that signal a slight change in that promise?
Well, it's an evolution because clearly the president has given up on the idea rhetorically and practically of Mexico directly paying for the wall. And I am certain in his heart of hearts, in his mind, the president believes that through some mechanism, even through in the renegotiation of NAFTA, if the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico is renegotiated and it's a quote-unquote better deal for America, the president will say, well, there's more money coming to us from trade with Mexico, and that's going to pay for the border wall. I mean, I think he'll find some mechanism by which he'll say, see, they're paying one way or the other. And that phrase, in the end, gives him that kind of a creative wiggle room, if you will. But as to the direct payments, no, it's not coming from Mexico. It's not going to come from seized drug assets. It's not going to come from taxes on remittances sent back to Mexico. If it is going to be financed, it's going to be very indirectly. The president may claim it, but it probably won't be true. The biggest problem for the president right now and what causes him tremendous frustration, he can't get the Republican Congress, his own party, to pony up the dollars that he wants sufficient to get the border wall built more rapidly than it's currently being constructed.
Just to confirm, the North Korea summit is on again, correct?
Not officially for June 12th in Singapore. That there will be a summit appears increasingly likely. And all movements on both sides are ramping up for a summit on the question of how and how rapidly to achieve denuclearization of North Korea. Whether that happens on June 12th in Singapore, that's still not official. It's still canceled until it's not. But lots of steps are being taken to have a summit at some future date. Every utterance from the White House, publicly and privately, is, if we can find a way to have it on the 12th, we will. But if it can't be the 12th, that's okay. We'll be ready for a later date.
CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett, host of The Takeout, which you can hear Sundays here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, Major.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The other day, we were talking with CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland about this new report on the attempts to rebuild Afghanistan, and I thought we'd bring Major Mike Lyons into the conversation. Mike, this report indicated that the rebuilding effort was essentially a failure, and I think of the thousands of soldiers here in this area who have served there and risked their lives. How are they supposed to take this?
It was some tough information that came out of that report, Dave, and it shows that we're actually going in the wrong direction. It said it might take up to another year before we even get, so to speak, even with regard to the situation there. There'll be a new commander coming in the next month, but no question that the United States has not poured the resources in there to ensure progress and not getting any help from the Afghan government as well.
So what do we do at this point? Do you see the report as saying that we just need to leave, or do we pour more money in?
Well, the challenge is the total number of Afghan security forces. We anticipated having 350,000 troops on active duty at this point in time. And right now, that number has gone in the other direction, 330,000 troops, and they think it's going to drop another 10 or 20,000. From a military perspective, that equates to about a division and a half. That's a tremendous amount of combat power that the Afghan government doesn't have at its disposal. So I think to fix that, it takes years. It's another generation that you've got to go. The education rate is still not where it is. The illiteracy rate is still very high in Afghanistan. And until some of those baseline infrastructure changes, you're not going to see those numbers increase.
The other hotspot lately has been Israel, and especially the border with Gaza. There were more attacks. What's the this has dropped out of the news almost completely now. What since the embassy opened there? What's the latest on these attacks?
Yeah, there's a real hot war taking place between Hamas and Israel right now along their border. And it looks like as of now, there's a ceasefire that appears to be holding in the Gaza Strip, in particular, where a lot of the violence took place when the embassy had opened. And this is, unfortunately, Hamas uses this to try to, gain some media attention. In this case, though, with everything else going on in the world, it hasn't worked. So it looks like Hamas is kind of back off now and give their people kind of a chance. But the Israelis are now building more settlements in these places. We're not seeing any resolution here anytime soon to what's going on there.
So they are building more settlements.
They are. They announced more settlements both in Gaza and then along occupied territories. The Israelis figure that they'll continue to trade off peace for land. And at this point, knowing full well that the other countries of the world, given what happened this last time, knowing that Hamas instigated what was those protests, literally put women and children in front, knowing full well that they would be killed. I think Israel is looking to take, kind of the moral high ground now at this point.
Who moves into these new settlements? Because I would think they'd be fairly, I've visited Israel, it's been a while now, and visited one of the settlements, and they're gorgeous, but the people there, at least back in those days, were always had to be on the lookout for snipers from the other side, for people infiltrating. It sounds like an insecure existence to me.
It does, and it is. And they move people in there that are passionate about what Israel's trying to do. And it's more or less a leap of faith in some cases, but they do provide a level of security that tries to make them feel comfortable. But it's possible that those settlements are often come under attack. And again, in the future, it's possible they might have to give those settlements up.
And as for Jared Kushner's attempts at Middle Eastern peace, any rumblings there?
Nothing there. It just doesn't appear that he's kind of walked the earth long enough to put together the team in order to to figure out what both sides want. And it's just, you know, it's negotiate or fight. And right now the needle is trending towards fighting. I think Hamas has decided that, that while the ceasefire is in place at this point, I think that I think you're going to see things ramp up over the next 3 months as the Israelis try to damper things down. They don't want to negotiate, and I think Hamas wants to fight.
CBS News military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Dave.
And now your daily dose of kindness. A North Texas elementary school teacher has come up with a unique way to come to terms with the reality of school shootings. She was inspired to take action by creating a chain of kindness before her students start the day. In this video, shot by teacher Ashley Taylor, a kindergartner stands at the door of the classroom and greets each classmate by saying good morning and their name, and then a handshake and often a hug, too. And each student takes a turn every day doing this greeting. Ashley says she hopes this daily practice makes a powerful difference in how her students develop relationships.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Mariners' winning streak is snapped at 4. Felix Hernandez started, but I'm reading that this was not completely a debacle. You found hopeful signs?
I don't know about hopeful signs. I think people overreacted. He left the game in the 6th inning. The bases were loaded. Each of those 3 runners he left on base scored. And it makes his pitching line look like the typical 5 runs he goes in and gives up however many innings he worked. And I think that because of the excitement that the Mariners have generated, it's created a little bit of blowback on Felix, where each time he doesn't pitch like an ace, there's an anger that's directed toward him of like, oh, this is what he is now. He shouldn't even be on the team and that sort of thing. And I think it's a bit of an overreaction. He's not pitching well, but I don't think that you've reached the point of no return, because the next step really is something you can't go back from, where they were going to, if he's not going to be pitching for this team going forward. And I don't think we're at that breaking point yet.
And forgive me for my ignorance, but whose decision is it for a pitcher to leave with the bases loaded?
That's the manager. It is ultimately his call. The pitching coach certainly consults on that. But it's a belief that, okay, you're not going to be able to get yourself out of this mess.
Huh.
We are more likely to prevent damage by having someone else come in. And watching Felix pitch in that last inning, I think it was the right call. James Pazos came in and he didn't pitch well. There was a wild pitch that allowed a run to score. And then another pitch it looked like he crossed up Mike Zunino, and then a weak single. So it wasn't like Pazos got pounded, but the Mariners bullpen, which has been exceptional over the past 2 weeks, was bad last night between Pazos and then Edwin Diaz coming in and giving up the game after the Mariners had tied it.
Well, they're still within a game of Houston, right? Which is pretty good. And
they're doing great.
Yeah. So I'm still feeling more encouraged about the team this year than I have in at least 5 years.
Oh, very optimistic of you.
Yeah.
They're 12 games above 500, and they've been hurt and suffered from suspensions. D. Gordon should be back later this week. There's a lot of reasons to be very optimistic
and
about this team.
Cruz made it out of the game safe?
Yeah, he did. He got hit by another pitch.
What?
Like
what?
4 times in 3 weeks. Yeah.
Oh,
he got hit by a pitch, and then he homered in his next at bat. Yeah, people need to stop hitting Nelson Cruz. Stop hitting him.
Let's get the Seahawks update. Brandon Marshall, I recognize that name, has signed with them. Why do I recognize that name?
He's been in the league for an awful long time. You're looking at more than a decade worth. I think he's got 12 seasons now. He's been an incredibly productive player. He's also an important player in my mind. His first 4 years in the league were marked by a lot of legal troubles, and I guess that's the euphemism you put on. Police were repeatedly called to his house for domestic disturbances involving him and, at that time, his girlfriend. He was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and I think that in a league where and a time where men in general don't talk about mental health concerns, his willingness to talk about the diagnosis, the treatment he's undergone, and the fact that his life has really turned around personally in the 8 years. He's always been a dominant football player. But the fact that you've seen a complete change in his behavior speaks to the fact that having a mental health problem is not, it's something that gets better when it gets addressed, that it's not some sort of burden that's always going to weigh you down and prevent you from fulfilling his potential. Now, for him as a football player, last year he played 5 games because of an ankle injury. I'm not sure. I hope he makes the team, but I don't think that's certain. He's a veteran that's being brought in here with a chance to compete and make the team, but this isn't a situation where they're hiring him with the intention that he's going to fix or improve all of the fact that this team lost 2 of its top 3 receivers in free agency.
Any other holes in the Seahawks team that need to be filled or players brought in to fill that hole or try out?
Yeah, they need some more pass rushers. That's something you'd be interested in doing, Colleen, lining up on the edge.
Sure.
Come roaring off of the offensive tackle to be able to sack the quarterback. I think everybody needs pass rush. They've suffered some. Cliff Avril's not coming back. Michael Bennett was traded. They need more pass rushers. That's also one of the most expensive positions in the league. I don't expect them to make any big additions in that regard, but that's going to be, in my mind, the biggest question for this team.
Danny O'Neill from 710 ESPN Seattle, our sports insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. I understand that Colleen was a pretty mean pass rusher when they played. She tells me they played Powder Puff football, and she was the chief pass rusher.
Well, that's good. She has a pretty good under move around the outside, a speed rush there from what I heard. She's not much of a bull rusher,
but
pretty
too.
Quick around the outside. Yeah.
I heard that too.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that thing on your rear bumper, which probably costs you a couple $100 to update every year. That being your license plate, a simple piece of metal, not much to it. But that could change because there is a new wave in automotive registration. It involves electronic license plates, LCD license plates. California is already experimenting with them, but they could come here as well. In fact, I talked with State Representative Mark Harmsworth about them recently.
Yeah, so these new license plates that are being proposed right now, there's a couple of companies that are doing, they're basically LCD plates.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some concerns because they have two-way communication with the state. And the idea is that the plate shows your license number mm-hmm. and your tabs. And then when you renew your tabs, the tabs automatically get updated wirelessly by the state on your plate.
Oh, so this is an actual active display license plate?
Yeah, they cost around $300. So your plate goes from $2.50 or $4 to create the plate to a $300 plate.
What powers it?
It's the vehicle's electrical system. It's kind of like if you're familiar with the ClearTex or the Paperwhite technology.
Yeah. On Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that, so it stays up. And then they can indicate if you stall on the car, if you're an amber alert or a silver alert or something like that, they can put it right on the plate. But they're also collecting telemetrics about your car. And that's where my concern is. Back to that data privacy again.
If you stole the car, can you just clip the wires?
You sure could. You'd have to remove the plate, but that's similar.
That's
to,
easy.
That's similar to taking a plate off today.
So is that being seriously considered for Washington State?
There's a couple of companies that are talking to us about it. I know that Arizona and California are piloting this right now. Again, I have some concerns about the privacy of this, so we'll see how it develops. It's very much in the early phases right now.
Hmm. Well, I want to make sure that it still fits my Cornell University license plate frame.
Well, that I can't guarantee. But if it was UW or Wazoo, then maybe we could actually go there.
Now, you heard Representative Harmsworth say that these plates would cost about $300. They're testing them now in Sacramento, right, Chris?
That is correct, in California, overall
and
in California.
And so what are the test cars paying there?
Well, it looks like the dealerships are selling them for $700.
$700?
So they're making a pretty decent chunk on these. Apparently, under the pilot program, 1% of the 35 million cars there, so about 175,000 cars in California, are going to test these through 2020 to see what they look like. Right now, they're just kind of being rolled out, but they're expecting this to be pretty popular once the dealerships start sending them out. I'm pretty interested in the ability to these can turn into advertising.
Yeah,
when the car is stopped, or you can put personal messages on there. Now, what I would do is I would put keep left in reverse letters so the person looking in their rearview mirror would be able to see me on their bumper and it would say keep left, telling them to get over
on
and stop left lane.
You're going to buy two of these things?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Whatever. If it'll get, but I'm not sure if you'll be able to put those messages out. I think it's going to just keep your plate number there until you stop, and then it can be used as advertising.
The message on my rear plate would be back off.
Yeah, well, yeah, you could do that too. You could do that too. But yeah, so I'm kind of interested in that. But I'm also worried, you know, in talking to Representative Harmsworth about, you know, keeping track of speeding and, you know, turning and braking, like the thing they do with the Good Driver account that you're working on, you know, collecting yeah. your, and whether or not at some point they'd be able to write speeding tickets or things based on what your plate is, as opposed to, you know, I'm worried about the privacy.
What are they going to do when they get it? I mean, they're going to be hacked, right? I mean, isn't it inevitable, since everything gets hacked, that eventually somebody will hack the license plates?
Oh, easily.
And change yeah. the numbers. I mean, it just seems like you're asking for trouble. At least with the metal license plates, you can deface them, you can remove them, but with these, you could change them so they look legit.
Well, that and also that might be a good way to make sure that you don't lose any revenue to tolling on the tolling if you're the government, because the plate would automatically read, so you wouldn't be able to put like something that hides your plate from the tolling cameras and things like that. You know, on the negative side, for those of you that don't like tolling.
By the way, the other day I was following a guy, and he had a license plate. I don't know if it was an LCBI. I suppose it could be one of these things, but in any case, whatever was over his license plate obscured it completely. You could not read it at all.
That is illegal.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
But how do you report that?
Because you don't have a license plate to give.
Yes, you can't see the license plate number. And I was thinking, that's a major oversight. How do I report that?
No, but again, it's like most of the other infractions, the officers have to actually witness that. And if a trooper saw that person, they would pull them over. Because, I mean, it's illegal to obscure your plate in any way, shape, or form. And covering it like that is certainly illegal. But yeah, these things are pretty interesting. I mean, you know, especially I do like the personal messaging.
Yes, I know you do.
though in a moment of
ambient induced irrationality,
you know, I might not. The four letter words should be prevented from being used.
You don't know any four letter words.
No.